Thank you, Jonathan, and good afternoon to you all. Good to be here, and it certainly was nice yesterday. I guess it's going to be chilling down a bit. Appreciated the first message. Yes, we are kind of in the midst of a baby boom right now. Some have come, and others, such as my daughter-in-law, Janan, and for Mrs. Pritchard, D-Day, I believe, is tomorrow for both of you. So that would be interesting to have them actually both come on time and on the same day. But it's good to see you all here. I want to thank the Fahys for always manning their post at the projection of the hymns, and for those of us who occasionally like to illustrate our sermons with some extra PowerPoint material. So just want to see if we are alive and well here. Yes, we are. Well, brethren, today I would like to continue the series of the sermons on faith, where we have three questions for God. Are you there? Second question, do you care? And third and final question, are you fair? We're going to be working our way through that in the coming months. Foundational scripture for all of these is found in Hebrews chapter 11. Let's turn there. Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 6. Hebrews 11, 6, the so-called faith chapter. Without faith, it is impossible to please God, for he who comes to God must believe that he is, that he exists, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. So we're addressing the issue, really, of God's existence, are we not? And we're doing that through a series of sermons, actually four of them. The first one deals with the evidence from the universe, the overall universe. The second one deals with the evidence of planet Earth, some of the unique features that Earth has. The third one, which we'll be doing today, is the evidence of biological life. And then we'll wrap up answering this first question of God's existence, or are you there, with a sermon on the uniqueness of humankind amongst those living things. God created the heavens and the earth. That's what we see in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. I'd like to spend just a brief moment or two reviewing the first couple of sermons that we had in this series. The first one was evidence regarding the universe. And we found that there were three rather strong proofs of the existence of God. Number one, according to the law of thermodynamics, within a contained system, matter and energy can neither be created nor destroyed, only changed or transformed from one form to the other. So matter cannot just spontaneously appear without a reason. We also showed that there is no eternity past of matter. Matter was not eternal like the Greeks and others thought until fairly recently. We can conclusively say that matter actually had a beginning. And therefore, if it had a beginning, it had to have a cause. Something or someone must have caused it to come into being. So matter had a beginning. And thirdly, there was the anthropic principle. Anthropos is the Greek for man. There are many values and constants in the laws of physics and chemistry that are set precisely to enable physical matter to be stable and to eventually enable life here on planet Earth. There's things like the force of gravity, the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, and other things like the mass of a proton, how much energy is converted from matter to energy during the hydrogen fusion process inside of stars. And they're all set so precisely. And what are the odds of that? There are actually a couple dozen of those, and they're all set just precisely so that physical matter can be stable and to enable life here on Earth. Then we finished that first sermon looking at some of the wonders of the universe. Its vast expanse, its ancient age, its incredible forms of and amounts of energy, the life and death of stars, black holes, nova and supernova, and quasars, and other such impressive phenomena. Then we moved on to the evidence of planet Earth. And we found that Earth has actually 12 characteristics that make it rather unique, that contribute to this planet's ability to support complex life forms and a wide variety of life forms, such as the color and the size and type of star that we circle, the nearly circular orbit of all of the planets in our solar system. The gas giants that help protect us from meteors and asteroids. The distance that we are from the sun in our circular orbit. The 23.5-degree tilt of the Earth's axis to help give us seasons and to moderate the overall temperatures on Earth. The composition of the Earth itself, its iron core that when moving produces a magnetic field that protects us from dangerous solar flares and other radiation from the sun. The uniqueness of our atmosphere, its favorable components, et cetera, et cetera. Now, very few planets that we have discovered have even one of these features. And to have all 12 features in one planet, the odds of that happening are truly astronomically small. In today's message, we will concentrate on the question, where did life itself come from? In our quest to prove whether or not God exists, I believe this is a crucial area that we should look at. You know, is life the result of cosmic good fortune, about rare events, improbable things happening frequently, time and time and time again, against all odds? And so therefore the dizzying array of complex life forms that we can study and observe here on Earth are just the result of random, purposeless processes? Or is there evidence and good reason to believe that life itself was designed and brought into being by an intelligence and a power far superior to our own? Are you there? Does God exist? Let's talk about the evidence of biological life and how it addresses the question, are you there? Evolution is a scientific term that in general means change over time. Okay, so things change over time, biologically. Indeed, we can see this. There are some examples. We'll talk about it. But there are actually two types of evolution. One is microevolution, and then the other is macroevolution. We can prove very readily that there are happenstance or happenings and occurrences of a microevolution. But when most people use the term evolution, they think in the Darwinian format, that of macroevolution. So what's the difference? It is fairly evident that microevolution happens. Studies have found that within populations of animals, there can be small variations within the species, such as the coloration of moths, the size of finch beaks, et cetera, et cetera. The coloration of moths is kind of interesting, where you have light trees where there's not a lot of smoke and soot and pollution, tends to have a predominance of lighter colored moths. In the more industrialized areas where you get more of the soot and everything making the tree barks dark, then you have a predominance of the dark moths, and of course it makes it harder for prey to see moths when they match the color of their trees. Okay. So there are indeed those kinds of differences, but such studies really provide no proof of one organism transforming into another organism, which is macroevolution. So adaptation within a species, or microevolution, is something that we can observe. We've seen this phenomena over the last century or so. Beginning in 1900 until 2000, people in the Western world grew several inches taller on average. And that was primarily due to improved health conditions, sanitation, and better diet. So those factors played into a small but noticeable change within the human population. Another thing, talk about dog breeders. They are able to produce a wide variety of animals, of dogs, from a Chihuahua to a Great Dane, from poodles to German Shepherds and everything in between. So such examples show that in nature there are these occurrences where there's a margin of change or range of possible adaptations that a particular species can make. But dogs have never evolved into birds or monkeys or any other kind of animal. Philip Johnson goes to the very heart of the matter in his book. It's entitled Reason in the Balance. Quote, Philip Johnson, "Critics of evolutionary theory are well aware of the standard examples of microevolution, including dog breeding and the cyclical variations that have been seen in things like finch beaks and moth colorations. The difference is that we critics of evolution interpret these observations of examples of the capacity of dogs and finches to vary within certain boundaries or limits, not a process capable of creating dogs and finches, much less the main groups of plants and animals in the first place. Continuing the quote, as any creationist and many evolutionists would see the matter, making the case for evolution as a general theory of life's history requires a lot more than merely citing examples of small-scale variation and changes. It requires showing how extremely complex biological structures can be built up from simple beginnings by natural processes without the need for input or guidance from a supernatural creator. So thus we have some cited examples of microevolution at work that we readily admit, but they're really no proof of anything significant to support the widely held theory that one kind of life form can actually change into, gradually morph, transform into another creature. Much less does it address how any creatures, finches, dogs, birds, etc., came into existence in the first place. Of course, the belief that an eternally existing God designed and implemented life on Earth is the logical alternative to secular macroevolution. Genesis chapter 1, we've already read that. I've got 10 parts in my sermon that I'd like to break it down into. Some of them are shorter, some of them are longer, so don't worry, we should be out of here on time. But I broke it down into 10 parts. And the first one is what I'd like to term the icons of evolution. The icons of evolution. Depending upon your age, whether or not you went to public school or private school, whether you went to a certain church or did not, attended college, et cetera, you may or may not be familiar with some of these things that I'll be describing as icons of evolution. By icon, I mean a powerful symbol of evolution. Something that when you see it in a textbook, it looks pretty authoritative. It looks pretty convincing. You know, it looks like, hey, there's some rather formidable evidence to believe in macroevolution, in the Darwinian theory. Icon number one. In 1953, a University of Chicago graduate, my dad went to medical school there at that particular school, Stanley Miller simulated the assumed atmosphere of the Earth billions of years ago and constructed for himself an apparatus of tubes and flasks and electrodes and then charged it and produced within this liquid a red goo containing a few amino acids. Now, this experiment was very, very significant from a historical standpoint, not a scientific standpoint, as we'll see, but from a historical standpoint, because it convinced a lot of people that over the years that, life could have spontaneously formed, could have arisen without any outside causes other than the natural forces here on Earth. But during the 60 years since the Miller experiment, new scientific knowledge has come to the fore, and what the Earth's atmosphere was really like have rendered his experiment practically meaningless and useless. Miller chose a hydrogen-rich atmosphere of hydrogen and ammonia and methane and water vapor as his mix because that was consistent with the current scientific thought of his day. But by the mid-1970s, other evidence came by, and it predicted very little hydrogen. In fact, most of that would have probably been driven off by the solar wind because hydrogen itself is such it's the lightest of all elements. Instead, they were pretty sure that the early Earth's atmosphere consisted mostly of nitrogen, carbon dioxide, and water vapor, unlike Miller's experiment. So now, in 1995, Science Magazine, which is a very pro-evolutionary publication, wrote this. Experts now dismiss Miller's experiment because the early atmosphere of the Earth was nothing like the simulation. Now, that wasn't his fault. Amino acids would not have been produced if Miller had used the actual mix of gases present in early Earth's atmosphere. Furthermore, brethren, even if natural forces did provide and produce and generate a few amino acids, there's a gigantic gulf between those few chemicals and producing actually any any form, any life form. Second icon, Darwin's Tree of Life. Okay? Darwin believed that all life forms that exist on Earth now are related through descent. In other words, they came from, through the various generations, came from some unknown prototype ancestor that lived in the ancient past. And so they had all these branches of the trees going to all the modern animals that we see now. So his Tree of Life purported to demonstrate multiple progressive life forms branching out from a single ancestral species. We'll address this issue in some further detail later in the sermon when we examine the fossil record. But suffice it for now to say that Darwin's tree assumes common descent based on common design. Descent says, you know, I look like or am like this other creature because I came from that creature. Design simply says, I may look like another creature because I have some of the same design specifications. I may not have come from that descendant in the past. Because let's face it, my son-in-law, Greg Baker, is an engineer. And designers such as engineers and architects may use, there's Darwin's Tree of Life there, but designers such as engineers can take common building materials like concrete and steel girders and rivets and maybe some glass or whatever and build structures that are very dissimilar to one another and serve different purposes. Things such as skyscrapers, bridges, concert halls, and the like. So likewise, a designer of life could take some common material and produce many different life forms from it. Evolutionists like to make a big deal about the high percentage of DNA that we share with some of the apes, some of those in the ape family. Okay? But again, it's assuming that that similarity is due to direct descent rather than the possibility that's simply due to design. Icon number three is the missing links. Archaeopteryx, here perhaps the most famous fossil of all time, is another powerful symbol of evolution. It has the wings and the feathers and the wishbone of a bird. But then some say, well, maybe its tail is a little bit lizard-like, or it's got these claws on its wings. So this is the missing link. This proves that, you know, birds became reptiles or vice versa. But in reality, it is simply a bird with just one or two unusual features. And we don't find transitional forms. Once again, we'll be talking about this in a little more detail later. But there's not, you know, 100 different small variations between something that is truly lizard-like or reptile-like and something that is truly bird-like. Those things just don't exist. Okay? And how often have you seen an illustration like this showing the supposed progression of ape-like creatures into modern man? See, the assumption of evolution is that all these creatures, once again, descended from a common ancestor, morphing over the generations into new species. But there's no smooth transition. For instance, you know, between here and here, you'd need to have about five or six more drawings to show the gradual change from something that's definitely ape-like to something that's maybe starting to look like humankind. Okay, but those don't exist. And it's a mistake, I believe, for we as Christians or for scientists or for anybody to go into any venture with preconceived ideas. For example, let's take a look and talk about Java Man. Java Man. Here we have a map of the country of Indonesia, which consists of many islands. Back in 1887, Eugene Dubois began to excavate caves in Southeast Asia. He hoped to learn more about human evolution and was determined to find out or discover an ancestor of modern man. He wanted to fill in some of these gaps. So with this goal in mind, these preconceived ideas of what early man should look like, he traveled to, first of all, Sumatra, the largest island in Indonesia, but didn't find anything. And so then he went to Java in 1890. He was in the military, and he was assisted by a couple of military men plus some convicts. and started digging in Java in 1891 on the Solo River. So Java is right there. Java is more than a language for those of you in the newer generation. Okay. Dubois did find some things that he felt were worthy of scientific study, and he felt that this was definitely a link in the progression from ape to man. But the findings, the bones that he found, was rather an incomplete specimen. In fact, it consisted, as you see there highlighted in the yellow, of just a skull cap, a femur, which is the leg bone in your thigh, and a few teeth. There's even some dissent in scientific circles as to whether or not all of these bones represent the same species, let alone the same corpse. Okay? So I personally would be rather reluctant to even speculate or reconstruct the head of Java Man, let alone a conjecture about what his entire body appeared to be like. Okay? So that's Java Man. Let's turn to Romans chapter 1 to see some of the prevalent beliefs in the Gentile world that Paul mentions. Romans chapter 1, we'll read verses 18 through 25. Romans 1:18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. Those of us who take a different perspective than atheists and evolutionists have a different belief system, and we believe that God has given ample evidence to show that there's a pretty big case here for a creator God. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man, and birds, and four-footed animals, and creeping things. Therefore God also gave them up to uncleanness and the lust of their hearts to dishonor their bodies amongst themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for the lie, and worshipped and served the creature, or the creation, rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Okay, so the pagans worshipped the creation instead of the Creator. And I love to watch nature shows. I've got all of the David Attenborough CDs, etc., thanks to some of my kids and Father's Day gifts and things of that nature. And those things are fascinating and so well done and so professional. It's just we happen to differ when it comes to evolution, and every once in a while they'll talk about evolution and, you know, evolution did this or did that, or evolution was very clever or applied this trick, etc. And it almost really personifies evolution, like evolution is actually a being capable of doing something. So I think that's an interesting concept. Let's turn back to Deuteronomy chapter 4 and see a warning that, I'm sorry, there was Romans 1. Deuteronomy chapter 4 and see a warning that God gave to the Israelites because I think any objective person will say this is a marvelous world we look in, whether it came into being spontaneously or whether it was designed and created by God. All of us, evolutionists and Christians alike, a lot of times have our jaws drop when we consider some of the things that are in our universe and some of the life forms that we can observe. Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 15 to 19. Take careful heed to yourselves, for you saw no form when the Lord spoke to you at Horeb out of the midst of the fire, lest you act corruptly and make for yourselves a carved image in any form or figure, the likeness of male or female, the likeness of any animal that is on the earth, or the likeness of any winged bird that flies in the air, the likeness of anything that creeps on the ground, or the likeness of any fish that is in the water beneath the earth. And take heed, lest you lift your eyes toward heaven, when you see the sun and the moon and the stars and all the host of heaven, and feel driven to worship them and serve them, which the Lord your God has given to all peoples under the whole heaven as a heritage. You don't worship the creation. You don't worship nature. Instead, you worship the Creator. You can stand in awe of the creation, but how much more should you stand in awe of the one who conceived it, who engineered it, who brought it into existence, and who continues to maintain it? Let's turn to Genesis chapter 1 to see a different explanation of how life came out to be on this planet. This is in contrast, of course, to Darwin's theory of evolution, or what we're terming macroevolution. Genesis chapter 1, verses 9 through 13. Then God said, "Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together in one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. Continuing. Then God said, "Let the earth bring forth grass, the herb that yields seed, and the fruit tree that yields fruit according to its kind, whose seed is in itself on the earth." And it was so. So plants reproduce after their own kind. And the earth brought forth grass, the herb that yields seed according to its kind, and the tree that yields fruit, whose seed is in itself according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. So the evening and the morning were the third day. Picking up the account now in verses 20 through 25. Then God said, okay, once again, according to their kind. Then God said, "Let the waters abound with an abundance of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the face of the firmament of the heavens." So God created great sea creatures and every living thing that moves, with which the waters abounded according to their kind, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. So you have reproducing after your own kind, that is within your species. And God blessed them and said, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters and the seas and let birds multiply on earth." So the evening and the morning was the fifth day. Then God said, "Let the earth bring forth the living creature according to its kind, cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth, each according to its kind." And it was so. And God made the beast of the earth according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. So there you have the three icons of evolution. And not all 10 parts are as long as that, I assure you. Part number 2, natural selection. The term natural selection was popularized about 150 years ago by Charles Darwin. He wanted to contrast or compare it with artificial selection, which we would refer to or call selective breeding. It's been going on since at least biblical times. We know that Jacob employed those techniques. Darwin described natural selection as the gradual process by which biological traits of an organism either become less or more common within the species, within the population. And it's considered to be a key ingredient or key mechanism for the process of evolution, of one form changing into another life form. Now, variations will exist within all populations of organisms. This occurs in large part because there are mutations that occur in the genome of an individual living organism. Therefore, a population of species changes over time. But we have to ask an important question. Does Darwin's description of natural selection provide really a credible explanation of how life started and developed through the ages? Well, there are three big problems with mutations. I know that's funny, but not to the horse that was born with those short legs, okay? There are some major difficulties with theorizing that mutation might be a means of positive changes or improvements in an organism by random chance. Instead of improvements, mutations overwhelmingly tend to be showing deterioration and cause handicap rather than an advantage, regression rather than progression, and inferiority instead of improvement. Okay? 99.99% of all mutations are harmful, and many even lethal. So only one out of 10,000 changes or mutations is potentially beneficial. In fact, almost every mutation that's been documented is identified or named by the syndrome or the disease or the abnormality that it causes, not for the benefit that it gives you. A reason why they don't show up more often is that we actually have two sets of genes, and oftentimes the good set tends to cover up or override the bad set. About the only example that's pretty common in the literature in regards to a good mutation is that of sickle cell anemia. Those who have sickle cell anemia in their hemoglobin are resistant to malaria, which we're all familiar with. But sickle cell is a disease itself and can kill people as well. Further, that mutation does not produce genetic information that leads to new species. Again, we're talking about changes within just a species. Mutations are therefore thoroughly inadequate to enable or to justify or to explain macroevolutionary theory. The second problem, they are rare. We can be thankful that mutations are not common. An average of one mistake per 10 million correct copies occurs in the genetic code when it's replicated. Whoever could type 10 million characters before making their first mistake would easily be the world's best typist and probably not human. Yet this is the astounding accuracy of our supposedly blind genetic code when it replicates itself. If, however, these copying errors tend to accumulate within an organism, that organism will tend to degenerate and eventually perish. Thirdly, they are quite limited. Reputable science has shown that the genetic code within each living thing has its own, if you will, built-in boundaries or limitations. The genetic code seems designed to prevent a plant or an animal creature from diverging or getting too far away from what's normal or average within the species. And every series of breeding experiments and efforts that has been accomplished on this earth has shown that there's a finite limit to what you can do with breeding. There are some boundaries that you cannot go past. So genes have a strong influence towards conservatism and only allow modest changes within a certain species. So in addition to mutations being almost always harmful and very rare and being quite limited, all three of those characteristics make it extremely unlikely that mutations can be responsible for major changes in the nature and characteristics of plants and animals over multiple generations. It doesn't matter how much time you're given. And thereby, the main idea supporting the concept of natural selection by Charles Darwin is rendered rather dubious, I believe. Point number four, gradual or sudden change. Gradual or sudden change. In his Origin of Species, Darwin states, quote, "If it could be demonstrated that any complex organism exists which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, then my theory would absolutely break down." Harvard paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould is one of the most prominent spokesmen and proponents of classical Darwinian evolution. But even he makes the following revealing observation. This is quoting Gould. "The history of most fossil species includes two features that are particularly inconsistent with gradualism, that is, the gradual evolution from one species to another. Characteristic number one, stasis, from which we get the word static. It's not moving, it's not changing. Stasis. Most species exhibit no directional evolutionary change during their tenure on Earth. They appear in the fossil record looking pretty much the same as when they disappear. Morphological, anatomical, or structural change is usually very limited and directionless. Two, second characteristic, sudden appearance. In any local area, a species does not arise gradually by the steady transformation from its ancestors. It appears all at once and fully formed." That's a quote from a proponent of classical Darwinian evolution. The Cambrian explosion is perhaps the most dramatic example of this outburst of many new life forms coming into the fossil history record all at once. Point number five, the complexity of life. A living organism is actually a hierarchy of many structures. Individual atoms do what? Bind with other atoms to form molecules. And molecules can be relatively simple, from something like a hydrogen or water molecule to maybe a sugar molecule or a fatty acid, or more complex like a DNA molecule or even proteins. Then the various molecules must combine together to create structures within the cell. The cell itself must combine in a coordinated fashion to create then functional tissues. Then an organized collection of tissues consists or makes up then organs like your skin or your liver or your heart. Okay, then multiple organs form bodily systems such as your skeletal or your musculature or your respiration system or your digestion or your nervous system or whatever. So those multiple systems, of course, have to combine and function together in a coordinated manner and integrate into an actual living being. And at each juncture here, at each juncture in the hierarchy, the evolutionist needs to come up, I believe, with a reasonable theory as to how such a transition could take place, how it actually happened, but no such explanations are ever forthcoming. Consider the cell. Consider the cell. In science and technology, how many of you ever heard the term a black box? A black box. The term black box is used to describe a system or a machine or a process that is interesting, that scientists find interesting, but they don't know how it works. Okay? And to Darwin and the people of science at the time, the cell was a black box. Because before the more powerful microscopes of the modern era were invented, most scientists perceived the cell as a relatively simple structure, simple in nature. It's a blob of goo, you know, this protoplasm stuff, and yeah, it might have like an outside kind of a border or edge to it, and it's got this dark thing in the middle that we call the nuclei. Early scientists could observe cells dividing and perhaps moving, but they had no idea of what actually might be going on within the cell itself. And they certainly didn't know how it accomplished all that it accomplishes. Well, the cell provides a rather compelling case, in my mind, to attribute life to an almighty life giver rather than to random or natural forces. The cell is actually a molecular machine, complete with sophisticated motors and incredible assemblages and all kinds of biological circuitry. Michael Behe, in his book, Darwin's Black Box, makes the analogy of the cell to a mousetrap. You have different components here in the mousetrap. You have a platform and a spring and a hammer and a hold-down bar, et cetera, et cetera. But if you just have those individual components, you don't have a functioning mousetrap. They all need to be positioned in the right place, and they all need to work together and be there concurrently. And a manufacturer, I believe, would never expect a bunch of small machines to gather themselves together, to assemble themselves into a cohesive functioning unit, no matter how many eons of time you allowed for that to happen. Well, a cell is likewise composed of many components, many more components than a simple mousetrap. And all those components must be present and in the right place, working properly, in the right position, coordinating with the other cells or parts of the cell concurrently. Otherwise, you don't have something that works. And a cell is so much more sophisticated and complex than a mousetrap. Really, this analogy, in my opinion, is rather crude in itself. So the cell is the basic building block of life. And recent work with more powerful microscopes, and especially looking into the DNA, Recent scientific study has revealed that the cell is incredibly complex, much more so than we ever imagined. So to me, an objective analysis of just this fact alone, what the cell is and what the cell is capable of doing, gives adequate belief for me or evidence to believe in an almighty creator God, and that this is an irreducibly complex structure that couldn't come into being with gradual steps. It had to be created once and for all, with all the components present working together in a coordinated fashion with one another. Point number six, the fossil record. Let's talk about the fossil record. Even Charles Darwin himself struggled with the fact that the fossil record at the time, meager as it was, failed in large part to support his theory of macroevolution. He asked the following, quote, "Why, if species have descended from other species by fine gradations, do we not see innumerable transitional forms everywhere in the fossil record? Why do we not find them embedded in countless numbers of the crust of the earth?" This is perhaps the most obvious and serious objection that can be urged against the theory. The explanation lies, I believe, in the extreme imperfection of the geological record. The geologists of the 19th century thought that really it's really only a matter of time before missing links will be found in the fossil record and we'll have a more complete picture, thereby filling in the obvious gaps that were there. But today, 150 years later, a century and a half later, we have multiple hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of fossils that have been discovered and observed and cataloged. And what is the conclusion of Science Magazine? Once again, a very pro-evolutionary publication. Science Magazine said this, "In general, these transitional forms have not been found, and yet the optimism has died hard. And so some pure fantasy has crept into the textbooks." Fantasy has crept into the textbooks because of the old belief, well, it's just a matter of time and we'll find the fossil records that support the idea of all these transitional forms that would be necessary to logically show and prove that one species can turn into a different species. There are no intermediary forms. Quite an admission. And to say that fantasy has crept into textbooks, and that's what people read, but if it's in your science class, it must be true. So the fossil record has been thoroughly explored and documented, and Darwin's excuse of an extreme imperfection in the geological record, I believe, is no longer credible, even in scientific circles, as I've just quoted. Point number seven. The principle of biogenesis. Biogenesis. Biogenesis is the production of new living organisms. And the principle states that new living organisms can only come from existing life. Okay? The previous belief that was held for millennia in the past was that of spontaneous generation. You know, life can just kind of spring out of nowhere, so to speak. It took about a century's worth of work between an Italian scientist named Francesco Redi with pieces of meat, whether it's exposed to the air and the flies can get in there and plant their larvae, and pretty soon you have maggots, etc., and about 100 years later, Louis Pasteur, along the same lines, only this had to do with broth and the green stuff that could eventually form into broth, etc., etc. But it took them a whole series of meticulous experiments in order to finally convince the scientific community that life could only come from pre-existing life and that spontaneous generation was a false concept. Life comes from life. Life cannot arise from non-life. And you know what? Evolutionists would generally agree with that principle. They would say that is correct. But somewhere in the far distant past, way back there in Earth's early history, that principle had an exception take place. The first spark of life, in order for life to initially appear on the planet. But then again, God's word has a different view as to how life and everything else came about. John chapter 1. John chapter 1, verses 1 to 3. In the beginning was the Word, a person we now refer to as Jesus Christ, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God, an eternally existing being. All things were made through him, and without him nothing was made that was made. Not a thing was created without the Word. Point number 8, DNA and information. One of the most extraordinary discoveries of the 20th century has to do with DNA, the unveiling of the human genome, and the fact that DNA actually stores information, detailed instructions for assembling proteins and thereby producing the different life forms that we have. It's a 4-character digital code, letters A, C, G, and T, stand for adenine and cytosine and guanine and thymine. Okay, there are 4 letters that represent 4 chemicals. They're all nitrogen-based biological compounds that are found in DNA. And different combinations and arrangements of these 4 compounds, these chemicals, yields different sequences of amino acids, therefore leading to the different creatures and plants and animals that we find here on Earth. There is a person called an information theorist. I don't know any, but people who just study the idea of information. Information theorists define self-organization, such as the crystal structures that we find in salt and other minerals, as being simple, redundant, and repetitive in nature. Okay? Self-organization. In contrast to that, information theorists define information as having complexity. That is variability, irregularity, unpredictability. And any reasonable scientist, in fact, any reasonable person, I believe, would recognize that true information comes only from an intelligent mind. Information is something that cannot be generated or produced by matter or energy. Information transcends the physical universe. Information is the hallmark of a thinking being. Nothing can generate information except intelligence. And looking at the evidence of DNA, we find that the data at the very core of life is not disorganized, but rather highly orderly and complex in nature. The human DNA molecule, a single molecule, contains enough information to fill 12 sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica, which would fill up about 50 feet of library shelf space. Yet, it's incredibly small as well. The DNA molecule is only 2 millionths of a millimeter thick. And a millimeter is this, so 2 millionths of that is pretty small. If you had a full teaspoon, not a tablespoon, a teaspoonful of DNA, it could contain all of the genetic information for all of the creatures that have existed in Earth's entire history. And, oh, by the way, also contain all of the books ever written by mankind throughout all of human history. Point number 9, man cannot produce life. Man can't produce life. Miller's famous experiment back in 1953 gave an illusion that somehow life might have come into being in a spontaneous manner from simple natural forces such as lightning interacting with an atmosphere and a little bit of water at the time to create the building blocks of life. Well, in addition to the problem of the nature and makeup of the atmosphere at the time, we also mentioned that there's an enormous gap between a few amino acids and even a simple organism. You know, DNA can form proteins, but then the proteins, once again, have to be assembled into structures that become part of the cell. The cells have to form tissue. The tissues have to be arranged into a viable organ. You have multiple organs working in harmony and multiple systems to create a single functioning living organism. So once again, ask yourself, how does this hierarchical arrangement of cells and tissues and whatever and organs of the body plan actually develop? And evolutionists do not have an answer for that. It's not even on their radar. The reality is that mankind, with all of his intelligence and all of his sophisticated technology, and using even the most highly controlled environment, you can do whatever you want, and you know, you can create a vacuum, create heat, you can smash atoms, all these super controlled environments, man, with all his intelligence, technology, and a highly controlled environment, cannot create even a single cell, let alone a living creature of some kind. Again, God's word reveals who is responsible for life and for creating the habitat for life. Back in Psalm 104, well, first of all, read verses 16 to 18. The trees of the Lord are full of sap, the cedars of Lebanon pictured here, which he planted, where the birds make their nests, and the stork has her home in the fir trees. The high hills are for the wild goats. The cliffs are a refuge for the rock badgers. So God's word here reveals who's responsible for the creating of the habitat and for the creatures who do the habitating. Let's also read verses 24 and 25 of the same chapter. O Lord, how manifold are your works. In wisdom you have made them all. The earth is full of your possessions. This great and wide sea, in which are innumerable teeming things, living things, both small and great. So God's word clearly reveals who is responsible for the creation and for life being on this creation. Part number 10 is a little bit longer, and I simply call this amazing life forms. There are so many extraordinary examples of plants and animals, that's flora and fauna, that attest to the creativity and ingenuity of the great being who filled this earth with all kinds of life forms. We'll only have time, or I'll only take the time, to go over 7 or 8 of those, just to further illustrate my firm belief that life just didn't happen on this planet because of luck, or the roll of the dice, or randomness through purposeless processes. Rather, there are many examples in nature, and I hope that these are 7 or 8 that appeal to you as well, that speak loudly about a highly intelligent life giver as the one being responsible for these life forms. First one, photosynthesis. We'll do 3 or 4 with plants, and then we'll wrap up with some animals. You know, just a few minutes ago, I made the point that mankind, despite all of his knowledge and technology and ability to control environments, despite his best efforts, cannot come close to producing life. Kind of keeping along the same vein, here's something else to consider. All green plants can take in carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and water from the ground, and then using sunlight as the source of energy, and the magic of some green chlorophyll, produce the basic sugars, the basic carbohydrates, to start the entire food chain of life. This is where it all starts. And oh, by the way, oops, gives off some oxygen as well for those of us that need oxygen. Okay? So it starts the entire food chain. How many of you ever heard the expression, and I really like this expression, hey, I just didn't fall off the turnip truck. How many of you have heard that? Okay, that was made famous by Johnny Carson, the longtime host of the Tonight Show from about 62 to 70 or 92. And the implication is, well, you know, we city slickers are more intelligent and more sophisticated than you hayseed farmers and country bumpkins. Okay. Funny thing is, any person uttering that expression, "I just didn't fall off the turnip truck," himself cannot produce food, even though he could have access to the same carbon dioxide and water and sunlight that the turnip has. And the turnip is even less intelligent than the people on the turnip truck. Okay? Another thing to consider. Another expression we might hear, do you know which end is up? Okay? Seeds know which way is up. There's a phenomenon called a tropism. That's from the Greek word tropos, means to turn. It's a biological phenomenon meaning growth or movement or turning or reaction of a biological nature, an organism, typically a plant, in response to some kind of environmental stimulus. And there are different types of tropisms or turning towards, such as a phototropism is a reaction to light. And a hydrotropism would be a reaction to water. Okay? In the case of seeds, there is a positive tropism that is in the direction of the gravity or the force or the stimulus, a positive tropism for the roots. There's also a negative tropism that is going away from the source of gravity or the stimulus that goes up so that the plant, the stem and the leaves go up in nature, away from the gravity. And of course, this is the way it would have to work so that the roots can get to the nutrients in the soil and draw in water, and so that the plant itself, the leaves, et cetera, seek the sunlight and use that to photosynthesize. Okay? So seeds respond to gravity, but it's still unclear. We don't know how this happens. Now, if any of us were actually buried in the earth and the dirt was fairly packed tightly fairly around us, I doubt that we would know which way is up and which way is down. But you just put a seed in the ground and kind of stamp down on it, somehow it knows where gravity is and sends the roots towards it and the stem and the leaves the opposite direction towards the sun. So plants are really amazing organisms. We think that because they don't have a nervous system like ours or a brain, that they can't sense their surrounding or respond to stimuli. But they really do and are quite successful at it. I'd like to continue on just for a little bit with plants before we go to animals. How many of you have ever seen the giant sequoias or redwoods out in California? Or possibly, maybe, are there some up as far as British Columbia? A little, I'm not sure. Anyway. Do you ever wonder how this tree gets moisture and nutrients to the very tippy top? 300 feet up. There's no elevators. There's no mechanical pumps. How does it happen? Well, if you observe water in a glass, there's a thing called surface tension, and water tends to want to climb up the edge of the glass, and that's called a meniscus. Well, as you make this glass become a straw or a tube, tinier and tinier, the meniscus pretty soon touches from one meniscus to another, and so then liquid would actually defy gravity and go up. Well, the redwood's tree trunk is made up of millions of little bitty tubes called xylem. Think of them as tiny, tiny, tiny straws. They're made of cellulose, and the water molecules, stick to the edge, and because it's such a restricted space, they actually will go up the tree 300 feet, and that's called capillary action. Another thing to think about, the flagellum. Back in 1973, they discovered a component in a bacteria called a flagellum that performs much like a rotary propeller. This micromachine within a bacterium can spin at 10,000 RPM. Now, most of our cars redline at, about 6,000 or so? I've never gone anywhere near that. I think 3,500 RPM is about all I've ever put my Hyundai through. The flagellum can spin at 10,000 RPM, stop spinning within 1/4 turn in 1/700th of a second, and then instantly start turning 10,000 RPM in the opposite direction. So that little item there is simply the most efficient motor in the universe. And if you look at it, flagellum there, the artist's description there, or depiction there, they look uncannily like a machine that intelligent beings would build, don't they, and construct? Something an engineer would design? Doesn't it look like that to you? Then you have the eye. If I did enough research, I could probably take an entire sermon time talking about this marvelous structure and still not do it justice. But do supposedly intelligent people really believe that something as complex as an eye just designed itself and constructed itself and integrated itself into the musculature and nervous systems and sends messages to the brain, detailed messages with the resolution of more pixels than any device of man's technology and differentiating 10 million shades of color? The process by which our blood clots involves a highly choreographed process of 10 different steps that involve about 20 different molecular components. And without the whole system in place, all at once, nothing works. Now, it's interesting if you read the literature, when scientists try to come up with step-by-step scenarios to explain how blood clotting might work, have gradually developed over time, they generalize and they use such terms as suddenly appears or is born or arises or springs forth or is unleashed. But I'd like to ask the question, what is causing all of this unleashing and springing forth? They cannot really propose a credible explanation of what would have caused these individual steps to take place. And like the mousetrap, it's an all or nothing deal. All of it's got to be in place at the same time, in the right position, functioning together, or it doesn't work. Let's talk about migrations. I've already made some derogatory remarks, right? I told you about the turnip truck. Here's another derogatory remark. Please, don't throw tomatoes, but here it goes. People sometimes talk in a derogatory fashion and describe someone maybe as a bird brain. Have you ever heard of that? Well, despite the rather small size of the bird's physical brain, many species, as we see here, and the Arctic tern is the champion of them all as far as mileage, many species of birds routinely navigate in an unerring path of multiple thousands of miles and arrive at a precise destination that enables them to breed and feed under optimum conditions on opposite hemispheres in opposite seasons. The monarch butterfly migration, I believe, is even more amazing from the aspect that it takes four generations of the butterfly to make one complete migratory circuit. Okay? Here's the life stages. It starts out as an egg, hatches out, eats milkweed exclusively, which makes its body toxic, not poisonous, but bitter and foul-tasting. That's why most birds will leave it alone. Of course, it goes inside its chrysalis. I'm always amazed, and this is off the cuff remarks, how something like a larva, which has a little bit of kind of solid stuff on the outside and is a little bit squishy inside, then you get in a chrysalis where the outside's a little bit harder, and if you ever cut a chrysalis when it's half-baked, what is it? It's almost pure liquid, right? But then somehow amazingly it comes out with some kind of dampish wings, and after airing out for a half hour, the butterfly flies off. So that's its life cycle. But what I find so fascinating here is the life cycle of the monarch in these four generations. The first three generations happen in the northern climes, beginning in the spring. And so each generation here lasts about 6 weeks from egg until they give off or they lay additional eggs. So they only live about 6-7 weeks for these first three generations. The fourth generation makes the big migration down to Mexico, and they kind of hibernate and kind of there. But they live for 8 months. Okay, so the first three generations, a total of 4 months, and then the other 8 months of the year is the monarch butterfly completing. Now, when you think about it, birds are typically what? They're born in one location, right? And they feed and grow, and then within a few weeks or a couple months at most, later then fly with the adults to the other location. And then they mature, and then when the season changes again, they return to the place of their birth. So at least the young ones have flown the route in both directions. The monarch, how does the butterfly know where to head for its migration? They've never had the opportunity to see the route or to fly the migration. And here it just shows the migration path that they take. They winter some in the Southern California coast, most go down to Mexico and a few in Florida. Of course, widespread across the United States during the warmer months of the year. I think that most of you are familiar with the salmon migration. They're able to swim upstream, always making the correct turn when there's a fork, not in the road, but a fork in the river or the stream, so that they unerringly end up in the precise location where they were hatched. In essence, what happens is the salmon detects and remembers the exact water chemistry of where he was born, okay, of their origin. This ability is made possible because the salmon's olfactory glands are so acute. They're judged to be 1,000 times as powerful or sensitive, I should say, as ours. And so they're able to detect extremely small differences in the makeup of the water chemistry. In one Canadian study, salmon and trout were able to detect a solution of one part human skin in 80, not million, but 80 billion parts water. The fish halted their migration for about a half hour before resuming their upstream trek back to their homeland. Two more examples, one small and one big. The bombardier beetle. This may look like a rather humble creature at first. He has an interesting way, though, of defending himself. The first And it's threefold. There's three characteristics that enable this weapon system that he has to be effective, yet not blow up in his own face. The first capability is that this beetle has two separate sacs, each of which stores a different chemical which its body generates. But when you mix those two chemicals together, watch out. There's an explosive force. Okay. So first of all, he's able to produce the chemicals and store them in two separate compartments. When he's threatened, the second capability comes into action. There is a fireproof, it's almost like an asbestos-type lining in its posterior, which quickly mixes the two chemicals just before they explode and are expelled towards the enemy, towards the predator. Okay? The third capability is also needed so that the beetle will not be harmed or destroyed. And that is, instead of having a steady stream, the beetle has quick, precise, pulsating jets that go out. Okay, so it's just a little bit of time, and there's gaps in between his whole pulsating bursts. So three very complicated but cooperating capabilities come together in an integrated manner for an otherwise rather simple, modest creature. And now for something big. The giraffe is another unique animal that also has a three-pronged or three remarkable cooperating capabilities. Because the neck of the giraffe extends so high, so many feet above its main body, it's required that his heart be very, very strong. Okay, he has incredible blood pressure in order to pump the blood all the way up to his neck, up his neck to his brain. So that's the first capability, is an unusually strong pump for a heart. However, when the giraffe would lower his head to drink, you can imagine with that much blood pressure and blood flooding down towards the brain, he's going to have an aneurysm just on the spot. He's going to die of a giraffe stroke. Okay. So the second capability is that there are spigots actually built in to the arteries leading to the giraffe brain. And those spigots immediately clamp down and constrict whenever the animal lowers its neck to drink. Of course, then what would happen then when he raises his head once again? All the blood would come rushing down to his lower body, and what happens then? The giraffe would faint. But still, at the base of his brain, right at the top of the neck, there's this sponge-like material, and that's what does most of the absorption of the blood when the giraffe is drinking. So when he raises his head suddenly again, then instead of rushing back down away from his brain and the rest of his body, it slowly oozes back down. So three very complicated but cooperating capabilities, once again working together in the giraffe. So in our three questions for God, we're still on question number one. Are you there? Does God exist? Today we have examined the evidence of biological life in trying to address the controversy of evolution versus design. And we now know that there are many compelling reasons to believe that the complexities and diversity of flora and fauna that we find on planet Earth is indeed the handiwork of a creator God. The final sermon addressing this first question of are you there, God's existence, we will look at the evidence of humankind, the very pinnacle of God's creation. That is what we'll cover in the next message in this series of sermons on faith.